a binary system, and we will see also some application at the end in cosmology or fundamental physics that we can do with binary systems. For simplicity, I'm going to consider a binary which moves on a circular orbit, which is, in fact, one of the most promising sources for both LIGO and LISA, because even if the binary at the beginning were moving on an eccentric orbit, because of the emission of gravitational waves, with time, the orbit is going to circularize. And because it takes a long time for the binary to, from the moment in which it is formed to the moment in which it merges, basically there is enough time for the binary to circularize. So to assume that the binary moves on a circular orbit is a very good assumption. Since I want to apply the quadruple formula to derive the gravitational wave emission, I'm going to assume that the binary is moving on this plane here, 1 and 2, and I indicate with theta, for example, the direction of emission of gravitational waves. And I'm going to indicate with the phi s the orbital phase. My 1, 2, and 3 will be actually x, y, and z. And so you can write xt equal to, suppose I'm actually in the center of mass of the system, okay? So r is going to be the radial separation between the two bodies. That could be two black holes or two neutron stars. So I'm actually describing them as point particle at this point, okay? So you don't see the structure of the body. So r is the relative distance between the two. So I write xt like the cosine of phi s t, and yt is going to be r the sine of phi s t, and of course zt is going to be equal to 0. Now, like it happens also in Newtonian physics, if the binary is initially in this plane, it's not going to move outside of the plane. Okay, the angular momentum is going to be directed in this direction here, and except if you have spin, if the black holes carry spin, then you can have a precession of the orbital plane, because the angular momentum is going to precess around the direction of the total angular momentum of the system. But this is not, assume there are no spins, okay? The black holes don't carry any spin. Now, if there were no emission of gravitational waves, the binary, I mean the two bodies, will just move along this orbit forever, like in Newtonian mechanics. And this phi st is going just to be the frequency multiplied by time. This is not going to be the case now, because as we discussed yesterday, because of the emission of gravitational waves, the system is going to lose energy, and so the orbit is going to shrink. In any case, given this orbit here, and by the way, since I'm in the reduced system, I introduce the reduced mass, which is going to be m1, m2 divided by the total mass of the system. And using the quadruple formula that we derived yesterday, which says that hij is going to be proportional to the second time derivative of the quadruple moment of the system, and the qij you can write like mij minus 1/3 delta j m kk, where mij is just mu xi at j. Okay. You can use this to compute that for example, for the polarization H plus, we get the following result. For mu R square omega S square divided by R C to the 4. R is the distance to the binary. And then there is a certain dependence on the direction which you are looking, you are observing the direction of propagation of the gravitational wave, theta. And then you have a cosine of 2 phi s. Okay, so there is a 2 here that comes when you take the mij here, and then you take 2 time derivatives, although you start with a cosine of phi and sine of phi, you at the end have a cosine of 2 phi. It's the fact that you have a quadruple, basically, that gives you that the gravitational wave emission will be twice the orbital, if you want, the gravitational wave frequency will be twice the orbital frequency, okay? At leading order, where we just use the quadruple formula. Any question, by the way, on this point? This is just a... Sorry? So the binary is moving on this plane here. So what is your question?
Is the system two stars going around, or is it one massive star in the center with the other one going
Oh,
around?
Okay. That's Actually, I'm not making any assumption about the two masses. So you could have either M1 equal to M2, okay? Or you could have M1 much larger than M2. And we will see, in fact, that, for example, Lisa could see a small body going around supermassive black holes, or you could have two supermassive black holes or two stellar mass black holes, etc. So up to now, I'm not assuming anything particular about the masses. So this is valid for any mass ratio. Okay? So then you can compute for the cross polarization. You have something similar, in fact, r squared omega n squared divided by rc to the fourth, and here depend on cosine of theta, and you have the sine of the 2 phi s t. Okay? So this is a kind of signal that we could see in the detector. Okay? So once the gravitational wave arrives, and interact with the mirrors in the detector, and then when you collect the light from the dark part of the interferometer, this is a kind of signal that could be buried in the noise of the detector. Okay? And we have a very good representation of it in the sense we can know in advance its shape. Okay? And I'm going now to discuss, in fact, what are the characteristics of this signal. But before doing that, another quantity that we computed yesterday, which is quite important, is the power radiated. So given H plus and H props, if you want to compute the luminosity in gravitational waves due to this signal, how big it is. Okay, so yesterday we derived the formula for the angular distribution of the radiated power. And we found that this was proportional to h dot square plus h dot square cross, if you remember. It was proportional to the, you have to take a derivative of h plus or h cross, and then you take a square of it. And if from this expression here you compute the total power radiated by taking an integral in the omega also, you get the following result. This is a famous formula. In fact, also this one is called sometimes the quadruple formula. You have a 32 over 5. Then I write it in this way, and you understand in a moment why. G over C to the 5. Actually, the reverse. So C to the 5 over G, and then Gm omega S over C cubed to the power 6. This quantity is dimensionless, so this is the frequency, the orbital frequency, Gm, the total mass of the binary C cubed, and then R C squared over Gm to the power 4. I write it in this way because, first of all, C to the 5 over G, it's a very big number. It's 3.6 10 to the 59 erg per second. However, this number here, which is the frequency, the dimensionless frequency, is to the power 6, is very hard to have it very large, in fact. In the example you have yesterday, you were plugging some numbers. Actually, it was not T, you were computing H. But it's very hard to make an object which is which has a very high frequency, and it's also very compact. So this quantity here, R C squared Gm, as you know, for example, for a black hole, the horizon of a black hole has an R, which is 2 times Gm over C squared. Okay? So this quantity here and this quantity here, especially this quantity here, actually, is generally, for typical masses, very, very small when you plug the numbers inside. And so although this number is very big, okay, when multiplied by something small to the power 6, it reduces this power a lot. And in fact, so, yes?
These m's that appear, are you assuming now that you have two equal mass things, mass m, or are these mu's, or...?
No, actually, in this formula here, what you have is just the total mass in enters here. Okay. It doesn't enter, written in this form, okay, it doesn't enter the mass of this, the mass ratio between the two binaries. But, sorry?
Okay.
Okay. One example I wanted to make, if you consider the system Jupiter, the Sun, okay, so Jupiter is going around the Sun like the Earth, and it's also a binary, although it's not made of compact objects, because Jupiter and the Sun are not compact objects.
So this is a bit funny, because I can let one of the masses go to zero, so essentially I have nothing, but they still have to get the same power, because... if that's the total mass.
Let me think a moment, because maybe in... okay, yes, because actually here, I should put here what we call the Church mass, not the total mass of the system. That's a good point, because the Church mass is mu to the power 3 over 5 multiplied by the total mass. So actually, it enters, just a second, let me check. Mu to the power 2 over 5. And so actually, it's the Church mass that enters in the formula. In fact, there should be a dependence. That's a good point. I don't remember who it is. Okay, so in the case of Jupiter and the Sun, for example, if you consider the fact that you could say, okay, this system also emits gravitational waves, okay? You can compute the orbital frequency of this system, and you find that this is equal to 2, 10 to the minus 7 Hertz, which means that it's not at all in any of the band of the detectors, because the gravitational wave frequency will be twice of it, and this is too low even for LISA, because I was telling you yesterday that LISA is... sensitive between 10 to the minus 4, 10 to the minus 4, 5 Hertz, and maybe 0.1 Hertz. Okay, that's the range. So it's not going to be in the LISA band. But also, if you compute the power, it's just 5 kilowatts. It's very, very low. So, in fact, if you compute the signal associated to this, it's much, much lower than this 10 to the minus 21 that we have been discussing up to now, okay? For the Hall-Taylor binary that we discussed yesterday, this number becomes, so for the Hall-Taylor binary, the power luminosity is 7.3, 10 to the 24 watt, so much, much larger, okay? And in fact, it's almost, I think, 1% of the electromagnetic luminosity from the sun, okay? So it's quite large, in fact. And the reason why it comes out to be much larger for the Hals-Taylor binary is because the two bodies are much closer to each other. You remember I was saying the orbital period is just 8 hours for this binary. It's not like the case of Jupiter and the Sun, and also because it's more compact. Okay? So this is just to give you some order of magnitude. Now, what I want to compute is that, so as I was saying at the beginning, if there is no gravitational wave emission, the phi st is going to be just omega st. But because of the emission of gravitational waves, the system is losing energy. So I want to compute how the orbital frequency varies as a function of time. And the reason why this is important is because the gravitational wave signal is not going to be a sinusoid like this, or at least it's going to be something like this for a very long time when the two bodies are very far from each other. But then as they approach each other, the frequency is going to in fact increase, and also the amplitude. And it's very important to understand how this happens, because the way in which we search for these signals in the detector is that we know in advance, we build templates that are very good, the faithful representation of the signal, and we correlate the output of the detector with our template. And when the correlation becomes larger than a certain threshold, then we can conclude that we detect the gravitational waves. So it's not that you switch on your detector and the signal is so big that you can see it with your eyes. I mean, you really have to dig out the signal from the noise. And the best way to do that is to build a filter, a template, and use a correlation with the output of the detector. So it's very important to know in advance how the signal shape, okay, over all the process in spiral and up to the end. Now, there is a very simple, Thank you. Okay. So let's assume that, again, we are on a circular orbit. So I can write that V square is going to be Gm. I'm going to use just Newtonian gravity here to deduce the dynamics, okay, up to a certain point. Now, as I was saying yesterday in the exercise solving session, if you assume just a circular orbit, you can write V square is just the tangential velocity. So it's omega square r square. And this is going to be Gm over r, okay? And from this relation here, you can compute r as a function of the frequency in Newtonian gravity. So this is just this formula here, okay? So now, the energy of the system, no, the orbital energy, is going to be minus g m1 m2 divided by the total r. And I'm going to use the so-called balance equation. I'm going to say that the amount of energy, the variation of the energy of the orbital energy of the system is going to be equal to the luminosity of the, if you want, the total power radiated in gravitational waves. Okay? So this is called the balance equation. And now using this equation, I can, and using the power that I wrote here, in terms of omega s and r, I can use this relation between r and omega s. I can plug here, and I can get how omega s varies as a function of time. And the result is going to be the following. So the result is going to be So omega dot s divided by omega s squared, which is a dimensionless quantity, is going to be 96 over 5. This chilled mass, this combination of the mass of the system, omega s to the power 5 over 3. So this is a very simple relation. And because this quantity here is proportional to the power 1/3 is proportional to V, because V is proportional to omega s to the power 1/3, just in Newtonian gravity, this tells you that this dimensionless parameter, which is an adiabatic parameter, which is very, very, very slowly, is proportional, its order V to the 5, C to the 5. Yes. Yes, I'm not very, I mean, in my notes I have all the factors, but here I'm trying to, you mean again this?
Just left your balance equation. Shouldn't there be a 2 in the denominator because you've also got kinetic energy and you've got to use the Virial theorem, right?
Yes, I'm using in fact the so you can write the energy like kinetic energy like potential energy, and then basically use the Virial theorem to express twice the kinetic energy to the
right, but that's just.
Yeah, in fact, you see, there I put E, but in fact, there I put E orbital.
Okay. You're saying there's a factor of 2 on the denominator.
Okay.
In the formula.
Yes, but I'm not using the same E. That here E is the E orbital. I'm assuming, okay, sorry, yes, there is an, if you want, it's not the same energy that I put in that formula there. But you are right that there should be a factor of 2. So what I wanted to say here is that basically this parameter, it's a very slow, I mean, varies very, very slowly over time, over all the history in which the binary is going to move on a circular orbit up to the end. And the correction is a very high correction in V over C, is to the power 5. In fact, we generally say because we count the post-Newtonian correction by dividing this by 2, this is a 2.5 PN correction. Okay? So if you basically develop the Einstein equation up to 2.5 post-Newtonian order, then you start having radiation reaction effects in the equations of motion that are due to gravitational wave emission. Okay? Now, an interesting formula that you can, in fact, derive that gives you an idea of how, which kind of, so in your detectors, when you are going to see the gravitational wave emission, depending on the total mass of the system, and depending also on the frequency, you could see either the inspirer portion of the gravitational wave or the last cycles before merger. Okay, and what you can do is that you can, for example, if you convert this formula here in a formula for the gravitational wave, okay, not the orbital frequency, you can rewrite this formula like F dot gravitational wave, which is just twice the orbital frequency, 95 over 5. There are some factors here, and you have G, the chilled mass, divided by C cube to the power 5 over 3, and then F gravitational wave, 11 over 3. And now if you introduce tau, which is time of coalescence minus T, you can solve this equation, F gravitational wave as a function of tau, okay? And you get the following result, that F gravitational wave as a function of tau is going to be 130 Hz I'm taking as a typical compact binary a binary made of two neutron stars, for which the chief mass is 1.21 M sun, okay? And then I normalize to a tau of 1 second. So when you solve this equation as a function of F gravitational wave as a function of tau, the dependence of tau is to the power 3 over 8, okay? So this formula is quite useful because it tells you, for example, that if you are looking at gravitational waves at 10 Hertz, okay? This means that tau is going to be 17 minutes for a binary, by the way, 1.4 solar masses, for which I normalize this quantity here. So this means that at the beginning of the bandwidth of your detector, like a LIGO detector, the signal will start, will last for something like 17 minutes, and then it will merge, okay? If you take 100 Hertz as your frequency, it's going to last just 2 seconds. And of course, if you increase more, it lasts even less, okay? So in fact, the bandwidth of ground-based detectors like LIGO and Virgo, we are really going to see the last minutes or seconds or even just milliseconds of the life of a binary system made of neutron star, neutron stars, or also black hole, black holes, okay? So how many cycles, if you ask the questions, how many cycles we are going to see of a binary system? Well, the number of cycles depends on, again, the total mass of the system and also the frequency. So you can compute the number of cycles by taking the integral of F gravitational wave in the T, and F gravitational waves is the one computed there. And you can work out this result here and get the following expression, 1.6 10 to the power 4. Again, I'm normalizing to a binary neutron star system. So when you do this integral, you can re-express the result in terms of F min, which is the minimum frequency. Basically, it corresponds to the, if you want, the lower cutoff frequency in your detector. I mean, the signal here will go between a certain minimal frequency and maximum frequency. But because the power is negative here, what counts is the minimal frequency, okay? Because the maximum one will be much smaller than this one. And so you see here that the number of cycles that you can have for a binary 1.4, 1.4 is of the order of 10 to the 4 number of cycles. And now 10 to the 4 number of cycles, again, if you want to detect the signal with a template, you have to keep track of the, you have to have a template which is very good, which has no defacing with your signal. By even one cycles can give you a bad correlation between you know, the output of your detector and your template. So this is why for many, many cycles, you have to be very careful in representing the signal with your template very, very well, okay? So you don't want to have errors larger than, for example, 1 cycle. Of course, you can imagine that you can build a template which has different parameters, and so you can still detect your signal because you introduce some systematic effect on your parameters, but you can still detect the signal because you can compensate the difference in number of cycles by changing slightly the parameter of your template. But then you cannot get a very good estimation of the parameter. Because one effect of the interest of detecting gravitational waves from binary systems is to extract information like the masses, M1 and M2. If the black holes carry a spin, you can know about the spin of the two black holes, etc. And these are all parameters that you can know if you have a good template that can describe your signal, okay? Are there any questions about that? About this? So when does it last, in fact, this in spiral phase? Because until now, I'm assuming that the two bodies are just moving around each other. I'm using a Newtonian gravity dynamics to describe, in fact, the evolution. But at some point, you can imagine this analytical description will fail at some point. Don't you think so? For two reasons, actually. One is because I'm using just Newtonian gravity to describe the dynamics, and I'm using just the leading order quadruple formula to describe the emission of gravitational waves. On the other hand, I should start introducing corrections. So, for example, the formula I wrote before, which was saying this is v to the 5, c to the 5, is just the first term in an expansion in v over c. So you will have here all kind of corrections, higher order corrections, that you need to include in order to be able to describe this evolution very, very accurately. And also, when we write h, like proportional to q, there are also here all kind of higher order corrections to the quadruple formula, but then you start having also higher multiples that you have to take into account, okay? And so there is all a community of people that try to describe the dynamics analytically using what we call post-Newtonian theory, which means that you try to develop the Einstein equation in an expansion in power over v over c, okay? But on the other hand, today, since actually a few years, people have been also able to solve numerically the Einstein equation for a binary system of two black holes with a computer. And in that case, you can include all the nonlinearities of general relativity automatically in your simulations, and you can get the signal also during the merger phase, okay? So one thing I want to discuss, and you have an exercise that you can do today or in the next days in the homework section. There is a kind of rule of thumb that you can use to decide up to which point you can use this analytical description, which is the following. If you draw the radial potential in Newtonian gravity of two particles that are gravitating, orbiting one the other, you find that the radial potential has this shape here as a function of r. Okay? And depending, so if you want, has this shape here, and there is always a circular orbit associated to this potential here. Okay? Now, in general relativity, this potential is modified when r is quite small, which means when the two bodies are quite close to each other. It has the following shape. Depending on the angular momentum of the system, if you change the angular momentum, so this part of the potential is very similar to the one in Newtonian gravity, when the two bodies are quite separated to each other. But as the two bodies approach each other, so R becomes small, you develop this other maximum here, okay? And so you have, if you want, an unstable circular orbit and always a stable circular orbit. And when you decrease the angular momentum of the system, these shapes here varies in this way. And at some point, there is a value of the angular momentum, let's call it L star, for which you don't have basically this maximum and this minimum, they merge in an inflationary point here, which is going to give you the last, what we call the last stable orbit of the system. Or if you want, sometimes it's called the ISCO, innermost stable circular orbit. And the reason why I'm saying that is because imagine that your binary, no, the two black holes, are going around each other for a very long time. Okay, so they can always be in a circular orbit, and we use them to say that the orbital frequency and the orbital frequency varies very, very slowly. But when they arrive at a certain point in which they pass this last stable orbit, they cannot be anymore on a circular orbit. And so what they do, they just plunge. Okay? So there is a moment in which you cannot put any more two black holes on a circular orbit if they are very close to each other. And this point happens at the R, which is equal to 6gm over c squared. So imagine the horizon is at 2gm over c squared, and this is 6gm over c squared in Schwarzschild coordinates for a black hole, okay, for just a non-spinning black hole. So when you arrive at this point, as I said, the two bodies cannot be anymore on a circular orbit, and they just plunge, and then they merge. You seem to be a...
Not described by a
constant state anymore
because
kind of. Yes, but this 6m, in fact, can becomes another number in the case in which the two bodies have comparable masses. But you can work out this number also, not so precisely as in the Schwarzschild spacetime, also for two black holes that have comparable mass. Okay? You can use, for example, position theory with all these corrections to get an idea of where that point is. Okay, and just to conclude, if you plot, so since I decided not to use the slides today because it was occupying too much of the black hole, but I cannot show you the picture, but I want to show you as a function of time what will be the overall signal that you will expect from a binary system. So the amplitude of the signal is going to increase as a function of time because we said it goes like v square, okay? V square cosine of 2 pi s, and v increases as a function of time. So the amplitude is going to increase, okay? But also the frequency is going to increase. And then once you form the two black holes merge and you form the final black hole, then what happens is that when you have a black hole, which is a little bit distorted at the beginning, it's perturbed, this black hole is going to emit what we call quasi-normal modes. It's like a bell, a black hole. It has normal modes that depends on the mass and the spin of the black hole. So they have a frequency decay time that depend on the mass and the spin of the black holes. They are quasi because they have an imaginary part. So they are damped sinusoid, okay? And so basically that will be the end of the signal. So it reaches a peak around the merge and then it just die out with some damped sinusoid. And now, so the interest of all this is that, first of all, general relativity gives you a very specific signal. So between, for example, a certain frequency and another frequency, you expect a certain number of cycles. If you have some alternative theories of gravity, like scalar tensor theory or a massive graviton theory, this will modify the signal. And so if you can very accurately detect the signal, you can put bounds on some parameters of alternative theories of gravity. Okay? And another, I think, interest in cosmology of measuring, observing gravitational waves from binary systems is that the signal H, especially if it comes from a binary which is at cosmological distance, like the binaries that Lisa can see, is going to be proportional to 1/ the luminosity distance to the binary, okay? It depends on Z and the other cosmological parameters. And it will, of course, depend, let me write it here, there is a certain dependence, again, on the chirp mass, and you have, let me write here again what we... And then the cosine, as usual, of twice pi function of time, etc. I put a z here because if the binary is at a cosmological distance, actually this chirp mass, the chirp mass that enters this formula, is the redshifted one. So suppose that you detect your signal and you can extract the frequency, the mass, this quantity here, and you end up with 1/dL. You can use binary black hole system as standard candles because you can get basically the luminosity distance, okay? And you can plot if you can get also the redshift in some other way, which is from some, for example, electromagnetic counterpart. Suppose that you have an event of two black holes, supermassive black holes that are merging. You have some shock, some electromagnetic emission happens because maybe of, you know, AGN disk around the black holes or others, then you can also detect the redshift and you can do a plot of DLZ versus Z that now is due to binary black holes, not supernovae, okay, that are used as standard candles. So this is another possible application of binary black holes in cosmology, okay? Of course, the interest in astrophysics is much larger because in astrophysics, people don't know even the distribution of mass of black holes or spins, and this is something that you can do with the observation of them, okay? Are there any questions? Yes.
The features of the signal depend on the, basically on the theory of gravity. So if we have a massive gravity, we're going to have something slightly different than GR. But you also said that to dig out the signal from the noise, we have to compare, the signal with some templates. So is the search for gravitational wave model dependent in this sense? So
yeah, so yeah, it's a good question. So if you want, in some sense, it is because so the signal is going to be very weak, and so to extract it, we need to use templates. Now, the templates today are based on the theory of general relativity. Of course, you can also, there are examples of templates that include effect due to scalar tensor theory. For example, if you take just Brans-Dicke theory, okay, you can build, and people have done it, how that omega s, the formula of omega s, that gives how the frequency varies the function of time, you can include effect due to the Brans-Dicke parameter, for example, if you are using Brans-Dicke theory. Or if there is a massive graviton, there is a Compton wavelength associated to the graviton that you can include. So you know more or less how the signal is going to vary. Yes. So if you want, at the moment in the search, we don't use templates based on alternative theories of gravity. But the difference is very tiny. So what I'm saying is that if you use a GR template, you are still going to detect your signal, okay? It's not that you miss the signal. Suppose that you have that the real theory is an alternative theory of gravity. What I'm saying is that the difference is really very small. So you first of all detect it, and you can do it with GR, but then you might realize that when you extract the parameters, some inconsistency come out, And that you can explain with an alternative theory of gravity. So the effect is not huge. So this is what I'm saying. It are very tiny, the differences. And I should also say that actually it's only with LISA that we will be able to really test, for example, alternative theories, because the signal-to-noise ratio of LISA in detecting binary system will be of the order of 1,100, 10 to the 4. So in that case, actually, you may turn on your detector and see the signal. But for LIGO, it's really very tiny, so you cannot do sophisticated, you know, analysis like testing alternative theories. Yes.
But how about extra polarization degrees of freedom?
Yes, so this is also another good point, because here, for example, it is assumed that in GR, as we saw, gravitational waves are transversal. So you have only transversal degrees of freedom, while if you take a scalar tensor theory, you will have also a longitudinal mode. And so, yes, that is something also that you can do. You can actually detect the polarization. But again, it's a very tiny difference. So it's not going to mess up, you know, your data analysis, but it's something that a posteriori you can go back and try to understand better and maybe work out that there was a longitudinal mode. So that's something else that one can look at. I think I started after maybe 10 minutes, but I don't have much more than 20 minutes or 15 minutes. So let's discuss. Are there other questions? I can move. Yes. Oh, thank you. Okay.
Can you tell the difference between this signal for two black holes merging? Is there a big difference between that and, say, a black hole and a neutron star or two neutron stars?
Yes, actually there is, because, in fact, this part, which is very clean and very simple and beautiful, is actually going to be very different if you take a black hole neutron star, because the neutron star is going to be disrupted at the very end because it's less compact than a black hole. And so because of the disruption, the material that makes the neutron star can form a disk around the black hole. And so this disk can create a bar-like structure, a bar that could start rotating. And so here you could have, for example, an intermediate region where you have an oscillating bar, and then you form maybe, you could form a black hole, you could form a neutron star. So you could have a very different shape here. And especially also if you have a neutron star, the same thing, because they are made of matter. So again, when they merge, the signal is not so clean as for two black holes. For two black holes, it's really very simple, in fact, because there is no much that the two black holes can do. There is no matter. So the shape of the signal is much easier. But here, it can be more complicated and maybe even more interesting from some point of view, because from the shape of it, you can also get information on the equation of state of the neutron star. The way in which it is tidally disrupted, for example, depends on the equation of state. And so these are things that you can extract from the observation. There was another, yes.
I was wondering, what is the precision in which you can pinpoint the position of the source with LISA, for example?
With LISA, actually, you use the fact that, LISA, it moves. Okay, it's not a detector like LIGO, which is going to stay fixed during the time in which the signal sweeps in the detector. In LISA, you could have a signal that lasts for 1 year or 3 months. It's much, much longer the time. It's not a few minutes. If you put a supermassive black hole mass there, you get signals that last for 1 year. And LISA moves over this time. And because it moves, it basically, because of the modulation, you can pinpoint the direction in the sky just with one detector, which is LISA.
But what precision? I was just wondering.
Oh, the precision. The precision actually is not very, very good, in the sense it could be a quarter or maybe a tenth of the spot of the moon in the sky, which is quite large. So you have many, many galaxies there. And so it's not, what you can do in other kind of electromagnetic observations. But it's something that people have looked at. And in principle, you can do that. You can pinpoint, in some cases, the galaxy from which it was coming. Were there other Can I move well, so although I also gave an exercise for the homework, but I wanted to discuss the gravitational waves from at least inflation quite quickly. But anyway, one of the reasons why I also prefer to talk more about signal from like binary system is because they are much more promising than the gravitational wave from the early universe, where you get a spectrum which is really very low, and only next generation of detectors are going to detect it. So it's very important, but it's more really for the future. So suppose now that, so let me, gravitational waves from inflation. So we change completely, actually, the mechanism now of production of gravitational waves, because until now I've been using the quadrupole formula to get Hij, etc. Here the mechanism is completely different. So first of all, you have to compute the equation of propagation, the equation for the gravitational wave, which means that you take a Friedmann-Robertson-Walker spacetime, and you linearize the Einstein equation, as we did in our first lecture, but with respect to the Friedmann-Robertson-Walker spacetime. And so this means that your dS squared is going to be minus dt squared plus a squared dx squared, where a is the scale factor. And you can also go in the transverse traceless gauge, in this case here, and you get the following equation, the box of Hij, which is going to be 1 over the square root of minus g, the mu, the square root of minus g. G is just the determinant of the metric. G mu nu, the nu, h I j equal to 0. And this one is just g mu nu, dx mu, dx mu. So I'm here putting to zero any possible anisotropic energy momentum tensor that could be appear in principle on the right-hand side of this equation. So this equation, which seems a little bit ugly, in fact, becomes very simple if you, first of all, decompose in Fourier modes the field Hij, and you go in the conformal time instead of using the cosmological time t, and you find the following result. So for the mode k, so you decompose in Fourier mode, I have hk that depends only on eta. So I'm assuming that basically h, so I'm writing the hij there as a function of t and x in a mode decomposition e to I k x, and then I have only the part that depends on time, which is the conformal time, okay? And you have two primes to indicate the derivative with respect to eta, and then you get two a prime over a, hk prime eta, plus k square hk eta equal to zero. Now, if you introduce what we call the canonical field, a psi k, which is just a hk eta, okay, you can further simplify this equation because psi satisfy the following equation. It's psi k double prime plus k square minus u eta, and u eta is a potential. Well, you can interpret it as a potential, which is the second prime derivative of A with respect to A. So this equation is the equation of an harmonic oscillator, okay, in a potential that depends on time. Now, let's do an example in which... so what's the meaning of that equation? Let's do an example in which we consider the sitter, the sitter cosmological phase, and then, for example, radiation. So the sitter just as an example of inflation, okay? But in that case, H the Hubble radius is going to be just constant. So the scale factor in a de Sitter spacetime is just one over minus one over h de Sitter eta. So it scales like one over eta. And if you compute a double prime, this is going divided by a, this is going to be 2 divided by eta square. Okay, so that's the potential. So this is during the Sitter time. And then suppose that you have radiation. During the radiation, a eta is going to be linear in eta. In fact, if you want to impose continuity of the scale factor between this value and this value, this is valid between the end of inflation that I'm indicated with eta star and eta equilibrium, where you have equilibrium between radiation and matter. Okay? And you see that here, eta a double prime is going to be 0. So during radiation, that potential is going to be basically 0. Okay, in this very crude assumption. So what is happening? So to solve this equation here, in these two regimes here, there are basically two different limits in which you can look at. The case in which k square is much smaller than u eta, and the case in which k square is much larger than u eta. And this two regime would correspond to the case in which the fluctuation is always inside the Hubble radius, or it goes outside the Hubble radius. So let's look a moment at this. Actually, I'm going to use... So suppose that k square is much larger than u eta, which means if you put, for example, if you are at the beginning in this de Sitter phase, this means that a over k is going to be much smaller than a eta, which is the minus 1, the Hubble radius during the de Sitter phase. And so this means that in this regime, which by the way corresponds to k, which is much larger than k eta, much larger than 1. So during this phase here, what you have is that basically so because k is much larger than u eta, only this term dominates in this equation. And so you can write the solution like psi k. For example, if you assume that at the beginning there are only positive frequency modes, okay, the solution will be just e to minus I k eta divided by the square root of k. And this fluctuation has a wavelength which is much smaller than the Hubble radius. So it's not even feeling much that the spacetime is curved, in fact. Okay? It will feel it only when the fluctuation becomes larger than the Hubble radius. There it will really feel that the spacetime is curved. And psi k of this order, written like that, means that h goes like 1 over a. So hk is 1 over a, this value. So it's suppressed, in fact. Okay, it's quite suppressed. And if you do a plot, in fact, of h minus 1 as a function of, for example, the scale factor. Was it the scale factor? Yes. So in this naive model of inflation, in which this is constant, this point here corresponds to a star, the end of inflation. And then you have, for example, radiation era here. Okay. So I'm talking here of a fluctuation that in this case is going to, it start basically below h minus 1 here, okay? And notice that if I plot here if I'm plotting here lambda physical here, which is proportional to A, if the fluctuation always remains inside the other radius, it's never going to be amplified because it just dies like 1 over A. Okay? So this will be this case here in which it never hit the potential barrier, or if you want, the never goes outside the other radius. So what's the interesting regime? Is the other one in which K square is going to be much smaller than U eta. So in this case, what dominates in this equation is this term here. And then when you compute it during the sitter, this is 2 divided by eta square. And so you can, in fact, work out that the solution in this case basically, psi k, so this is the case in which k square is much smaller than u eta, is going to be just a constant. This is actually ak multiplied by a, but the hk is going to be just a constant. So the more the fluctuation remains outside the upper radius, the more it remains constant. And so you can think of it that it's not going to be, it's not going to decrease like 1 over a with respect to the modes that always stay inside the upper radius. And by the way, the fluctuation, for example, goes outside of the upper radius here, and then it can re-enter during radiation. But it could go out very early in time, and then it re-enters during matter. For example, if we disregard the dark energy era, which we should not, but let's a moment forget about the dark energy era today. So the fluctuations that, like with the CMB, you can see are the one that went out of the upper radius at the very beginning, in fact, no? In fact, when we say that with COBE, we look at fluctuation that went out of the upper radius at a very early time. While gravitational wave detectors like LIGO at 100 Hz are going to see fluctuations that went out of the upper radius quite late, in fact, because they re-entered during radiation then. So at 100 Hz, we see gravitational waves that re-entered quite early during the radiation era. So completely different from what you can see in the CMB, okay? Now, I don't have the time to explain in detail how you compute the spectrum, but basically the idea is that when the fluctuation re-enter during the radiation era, you can again use this equation, and in the radiation era, it happens that this is zero, and so you can write because A double prime is zero. And so you can write the solution as a combination of positive and negative frequency. So during the radiation era, you will have that psi k is going to be e2 minus I k eta plus e2 plus I k eta. And even if you started from a positive frequency wave, you end up with a positive frequency and the negative frequency wave. And this fact that you start with a positive frequency and you end up negative and positive, it's in particle physics or theoretical physics called the Bogoliubov transformation. Maybe sometimes you heard this. And you create particles from vacuum, basically. And the number of particles that you create is proportional to this beta k squared. Okay, and what happens is that when you do this exercise precisely, for example, in the sitter, you can compute how much is this beta k, okay, by basically writing this during the radiation era and writing the same quantity during inflation, imposing the continuity of psi and its first time derivative at the transition point, you can get alpha and beta. Then you take the square, and you get the number of particles that are produced at that k. And then you can compute, this will be my last. So what we call omega gravitational wave is 1 over rho c, the derivative of the log of the energy in gravitational wave with respect to d rho gravitational wave d log f. And this you can write like 16 pi square f to the power 4 nf divided by rho c. So you know this, okay? So you can plug this here. And what you find for inflation is that for fluctuation that re-enter during the radiation era, omega is going to be constant, in fact. Doesn't depend on the frequency. So this is a result that maybe you already know. This is 4 10 to the minus 14, quite small. And it depends on the Hubble radius during inflation, which this is minus 5 to the power 2. And these are for frequency between the equilibrium frequency, matter radiation, and this final frequency here is, it basically depends on the frequency associated to this point here, because the spectrum goes up to 10 to the 10 hertz, okay? So that's the frequency. So it's flat, it's very small. Today, LIGO has actually just arrived to the so-called the nucleosynthesis bound, which is 10 to the minus 6, this number, okay? So this number could be reached by really advanced detectors, advanced LISA missions, for example, and also third generation of gravitational wave detectors on the ground, but not with the current ones and even advanced LIGO, okay? I should say that this is true in you know, like an inflation like the sitter. In slow-lower inflation, the difference is that H is not constant. H minus 1 decreases slightly, and so it creates a tilt. And so you have a tilt here, it's slightly dependent on the frequency. Unfortunately, it goes in the wrong direction because the tilt is a negative tilt. So at higher frequency, this is also a little bit smaller than what it is at very low frequency. So it doesn't help in that. At frequency like 100 hertz, it's going to be lower than a frequency of 10 to the minus 16 hertz. And you might know that during that at frequency smaller than equilibrium, the spectrum goes like f to the minus 2. Okay, it changes slope for fluctuation that re-enter during matter. This can change abruptly also if you have other kind of cosmology. If inflation is not an expansion but is more a contraction, like in bouncing universe, then you get a different spectral slope. In fact, it's going to be positive in that case. So there are alternative cosmology that could produce a different spectrum in the sense that it depends on the frequency. But it's very, these are really more exotic models, I would say. So standard inflation would produce something which is very flat or slightly dependent on the frequency. I think I will stop here. but if you have questions.
Yes?
How would you measure such a thing? Against noise, because I imagine that.
OK, so this is actually a stochastic background of gravitational waves. And so the problem is that you cannot use one detector because you will basically the noise is also stochastic in the detector. So what you do is that you have to correlate two detectors. So you take two detectors like LIGO and you do a correlation between them to be able to distinguish this from the noise, the stochastic noise, fluctuation noise of the detector. So there is a way of doing it. Yes.
So since we entered in a land of nominations, so in principle, we were not able to see the smallest nodes. we'll never see them because they will never re-enter.
Yeah, it could be that, well, certainly there are, you mean, after radiation, then you have, for example, a Mercury and then a cosmological, but you could have, are you saying that there are no fluctuations that go out here and re-enter during the,
Yeah, it seems like, so if we re-enter, as soon as we are in the land of domination, so nothing else will re-enter.
Ah, yes, oh, I see what you mean.
Because usually the under like the smallest mode is the most interesting.
Yes, but yeah. By the way, notice here that it's very important to have inflation to have this mechanism, because if you didn't have inflation, there are no fluctuations that go out during radiation and re-enter during matter. So it's very important to have inflation. Okay, stop.
Okay, and there are no more questions. We'll thank Alessandra for a very nice set of